tanks, he muttered. Bloody tanks. I say, an Eagle Scout in our midst, murmured Gareth, sitting comfortably up on the turret of Priscilla the Pig. A tenderfoot might have thought those tracks were made by a dinosaur, but you can't fool old Hawkeye Barton, the son of the Texas prairies. And he reached out to stub his cheroot against the side of the turret, an action which he knew would annoy Jake intensely. Jake grunted and stood up. I'm going to buy you an ashtray for your next birthday. His voice was brittle. It didn't matter that his beloved cars might be shot at by rifle, machine gun, and now by cannon, that they'd been scarred by flying gravel and harsh thorn. The deliberate crushing of burning tobacco against the fighting steel annoyed him, as he knew it was meant to. Sorry, old son. Gareth grinned easily. Slipped my mind. Won't happen again. Jake swung up the side of the car and dropped into the driver's seat, keeping the engine noise down to a low murmur, a sound as sweet and melodious in his ears as a Bach concerto. He let Priscilla move away across the moon-gilded plain. When Jake and Gareth were alone like this, out on a reconnaissance or working together in the gorge, the dagger of rivalry was sheathed, and their relationship was relaxed and comforting, spiced only by the mild needling and jostling for position. It was only in Vicky Camberwell's physical presence that the knife came out. Jake thought about it now, thought about the three of them, as he did a great deal each day. He knew that after the magical night when he and Vicky had known each other on the hard desert earth, she was his woman. It was too wonderful an experience to have shared with another human being for it not to have marked and changed both of them profoundly. Yet in the weeks since then, there had been little opportunity for reaffirmation. A single stolen afternoon by a tall, mist-smoking waterfall in the gorge, a narrow ledge of black rock, cool with shadow and green with soft beds of moss, and screened from prying eyes by the overhang of the precipice. The moss had been as soft as a feather bed, and afterwards they swam naked together in the swirling cauldron of the pool, and her body had been slim and pale and lovely through the dark water. Then again he'd watched her with Gareth Swells, the way she laughed or leaned close to him and listened to a whispered comment and the mock modest shock at his outrageous sallies, laughter in her eyes and on her lips. Once she touched his arm, a thoughtless gesture while in conversation with Gareth, a gesture so intimate and possessive that Jake had felt the black, jealous anger fill his head. There was no cause for it. Jake knew that. He couldn't believe she was fool enough or so naive as to walk into the obvious web that Gareth was weaving. She was Jake's woman. What they'd done together, their loving, was so wonderful, so completely once in a lifetime, it was not possible she could turn aside to anyone else. Yet between Vicky and Gareth, there was the laughter and the shared jokes. Sometimes he'd seen them together, standing on a rock promontory above the camp or walking in the grove of camel thorn trees, leaning towards each other as they talked. Once or twice they'd both been absent from the camp at the same time, for as long as a complete morning. But it meant nothing, he knew that. Sure, she liked Gareth Swells. He could understand that. He liked Gareth also. More than liked, he realized. It was rather a deep, comradely feeling of affection. You could not be drawn by his fine looks, his mocking sense of the ridiculous and the deep certainty that below that polished exterior and the overplayed role of the foppish rogue was a different, a real person. Yeah. Jake sardonically grinned into the darkness, steering the car south and east, around the sky glow that marked the Italian fortifications at the wells. I love the guy. I don't trust him, but I love him. Just as long as he keeps the hell away from my woman. Gareth stooped out of the turret at that moment and tapped his shoulder. There's a ravine ahead and to the left. It should do, he said. And Jake swung towards it and halted again. It's deep enough, he gave his opinion. And we should be able to see across to the ridge and cover all the ground to the east once the sun comes up. Gareth pointed to the glow of the Italian searchlights, and then swept his arm widely across the open desert beyond. "That looks like where they hold their fun and games every day. We should get a grandstand view from here. We better get under cover now." They intended to spend the whole of that day observing the activity of the Italian squadron, pulling out again under cover of darkness. So Jake reversed Priscilla gingerly down the steep slope of the ravine, backing and filling carefully, until she was in a hull-down position below the bank, with just the top of her turret exposed, but facing back towards the west, with her front wheels at a point in the bank which you could climb handily, if a quick start and a fast escape were necessary. He switched off the engine, and the two of them armed themselves with machetes and wandered about in the open, hacking down the small wiry desert brush and then piling it over the exposed turret until from 100 yards it blended into the desert landscape. Jake spilled gasoline from one of the spare cans into a bucket of sand, then placed the bucket in the bottom of the ravine and put a match to it. They crouched over the primitive stove, warming themselves against the desert chill while the coffee brewed. They were silent, thawing out slowly, each thinking his own thoughts. "I think we've got a problem," said Jake at last, as he stared into the fire.
"With me, that condition goes back as far as I can remember," Gareth agreed politely. "But apart from the fact that I'm stuck in the middle of a horrible desert with savages and bleeding hearts for company, with an army of eye ties trying to kill me, broke, except for a post-dated check of dubious value, not a bottle of the old Charlie within 100 miles, no immediate prospect of escape, apart from that, I'm in very good shape."
"I was thinking of Vicky."
"Ah, Vicky.
You know that I am in love with her."
"You surprise me."
Gareth grinned devilishly in the flickering firelight.
"Is that why you've been mooning around with that soppy look on your face, bellowing like a bull moose in the mating season? Good Lord, I'd never have guessed, old boy."
"I'm being serious, Gary."
"That, old son, is one of your problems. You take everything too seriously. I'm prepared to offer odds of 3-1 that your mind is already set on the ivy-covered cottage, bulging with ghastly brats."
"That's the picture," Jake cut in sharply. "It's that serious, I'm afraid. How do we stand?" Gareth drew 2 cigars from his breast pocket, placed one between Jake's lips, lit a dry twig from the fire, and held it for him. The mocking grin dropped from his lips, and his voice was suddenly thoughtful. But the expression in his eyes was hard to read in the uncertain firelight.
"Down in Cornwall is a place I know. 150 acres. Comfortable old farmhouse, of course. I'd have to do it up a bit, but the cattle sheds are in good nick. Always did fancy myself as a country squire. Bit of hunting and shooting, in between tilling the earth and squirting the milk out of the cows. Might even run to 3 or 4 brats at that. 14,000 quid and a whacking great mortgage bond. I could just about swing it."
They were both silent then, as Jake poured the coffee and doused the fire and squatted again, facing Gareth.
"Is that serious?"
Gareth said at last. "So, there isn't going to be a truce? No gentleman's agreement?" Jake murmured into his mug.
"Tooth and claw, I'm afraid," said Gareth. "May the best man win. And we'll name the first brat after you, that's a promise."
They were silent again, each of them lost in his own thoughts, sipping at the mugs and sucking on their cheroots. "One of us could get some sleep," said Jake at last.
"Spin you for it."
Gareth flipped a silver Maria Theresa dollar and caught it neatly on his wrist.
"Heads," said Jake.
"Tough luck, old son."
Gareth pocketed the coin and flicked out the coffee grounds from his mug. Then he went to spread his blanket on the sandy ravine bottom under Priscilla the pig's chassis. Jake shook him gently in the dawn and cautioned him with a touch of the lips. Gareth came swiftly awake, blinking his eyes and smoothing back his hair with both hands, then rolling to his feet and following Jake quickly up the side of Priscilla's hull. The dawn was a silent explosion of red and gold and brilliant apricot that fanned out across half the eastern sky, touched the high ground with fire, but left the long grey-blue shadows smeared across the low places. The crescent of the sinking moon, low on the western horizon, was white as a shark's tooth. "Listen," said Jake, and Gareth turned his head slightly to catch the tremble of sound in the silence of the dawn. "Hear it?" Gareth nodded and lifted his binoculars. Slowly he swept the distant, sun-touched ridges. "There," said Jake sharply. Gareth swung his glasses in the direction of Jake's arm. Some miles off, a string of dark, indefinite blobs were moving through one of the depressions in a gently undulating terrain. They looked like beads on a rosary. Even in the magnifying lens of the glasses, they were too far off and too dimly lit to afford details. They watched them, following the almost sinuous line as it snaked across their front, until the leading blob drew the line up the gentle slope of ground. As it reached the crest, it was struck with startling suddenness by the low golden sun. In the still, cool air, there was no distortion, and the dramatic sidelighting made every detail of its low profile clear and crisp. CV-3 cavalry tanks, said Gareth, without hesitation. 50 horsepower alpha engines, 10 centimeters of frontal armor, and a top speed of 18 miles an hour. It was as though he were reading the specifications from a catalogue, and Jake remembered that these were part of his stock in trade. There's a crew of 3, driver, loader, gunner, and commander. It looks as though they're mounting the 50mm Spandau. They're accurate 1,000 yards. The rate of fire is 15 rounds a minute. As he was speaking, the leading tank dropped from sight over the reverse slope of the ridge, followed in quick succession by the 5 others, and their engine noise droned away into silence. Gareth lowered his glasses and grinned ruefully. Well, we're a little out of our class. Those Spandaus are in fully revolving turrets. We're outgunned all to hell. We're faster than they are, said Jake hotly, like a mother whose children has been scorned. And that, old son, is all we are, grunted Gareth. How about a bite of breakfast? It's going to be a long, hard day. Sit out before it's dark enough to head for home. They ate tinned Irish stew, heated over the bucket, and smeared on thick, spongy hunks of unleavened bread, washed down by tea, strong and sweet, with condensed milk and lumpy brown sugar. The sun was well up before they finished. Jake belched softly. My turn to sleep, he said, and he curled up like a big brown dog in the shade under the hull. Gareth tried to make himself comfortable against the turret and keep watch out across the open plain, where the mirage was already starting to quiver and fume in the rising heat. He congratulated himself comfortably on his choice of shift. He'd have a few good hours of sleep in the night, and now he had the comparative cool of the morning. By the time it was Jake's turn on watch again, the sun would be frizzling and Priscilla's hull hot as a wood stove. Look out for number one, he murmured, and took a leisurely sweep of the land with the glasses. There was no way that an Italian patrol could surprise them here. He'd selected the stakeout with the soldier's eye for ground, and he congratulated himself again as he slumped in relaxation against the turret and lit a cheroot. Now, he thought, just how do you take on a squadron of cavalry tanks without artillery, minefields, or armor-piercing guns? And he let his mind tease and worry the problem. A couple of hours later, he decided that there were ways, but all of them depended on having the tanks come in at the right place, from the right direction, at the right time. Which, of course, is an animal of a completely different breed. And that took a lot more thought. Another hour later, he knew there was only one way the Italian armoured squadron could be made to cooperate with his own destruction. The jolly old donkey and the carrot trick again, he thought. Now all we need is a carrot. Instinctively, he looked down at where Jake lay curled. Jake hadn't moved once in all the hours. Only the deep, soft rumble of his breathing showed that he was still alive. Gareth felt a prickle of irritation that he should be enjoying such undisturbed rest. The heat was a heavy, oppressive pall, pressing down upon the earth, beating like a gong upon Gareth's head. The sweat dried almost instantly upon his skin, leaving a rime of salt crystals, and he screwed up his eyes as he swept the horizon with the glasses. The glare and the mirage had obscured the horizon, blotted out even the nearest ridges behind a shifting, throbbing curtain of hot air that seemed thick as water, swirling and spiralling in wavering columns and sluggish eddies. Gareth blinked his eyes and shook the drops of sweat from his eyebrows. He glanced at his watch. It was still another hour until Jake's shift, and he contemplated putting his watch forward. It was distinctly uncomfortable up on the hull in the sun, and he glanced again at the sleeping form in the shade. Just then, he caught a sound on the thick, heated air, a soft quiver of sound, like the hive murmur of bees. There was no way in which to tell the direction of the sound, and Gareth crouched attentively, straining for it. It faded and returned, faded and returned again, but this time stronger and more definite. The configuration of the land and the flawed and heat-faulted air were playing tricks on his ear. Suddenly the volume of sound climbed swiftly, becoming a humming growl that shook in the heat. Gareth swung the glasses to the east. It seemed to emanate from the whole curve of the eastern horizon, like the animal growl of the surf. For an instant, the glare and swirling mirage opened enough for him to see a huge, darkly distorted shape, a grotesque, lumbering monster on four stilt-like legs, seeming as tall as a double-story building. Then the mirage closed down again swiftly, leaving Gareth blinking with doubt and alarm of what he'd seen. But now the growl of sound beat steadily in the air. "Jake!" he called urgently, and was answered by a snort and a changed volume of a snore. Gareth broke off a branch from the layer of camouflage and tossed it at the reclining figure. It caught Jake in the back of the neck, and he came angrily awake, one fist bunched and ready to punch. "What the hell?" he snarled. "Come up here!" called Gareth. "I can't see a damn thing," muttered Jake, standing high on the turret and peering eastwards through the glasses. The sound was now a deep, drumming growl, but the wall of glare and mirage was close and impenetrable. "There!" shouted Gareth. "Oh, my God!" cried Jake. The huge shape leapt out at them suddenly, very close, very black and tall, blown up by distortion and mirage to gargantuan proportions. Its shape changed constantly, so at one moment it looked like a four-masted ship under a full suit of black sails, then it altered swiftly into a towering black tadpole shape that wriggled and swam through the soupy air. "What the hell is it?" Gareth demanded. "I don't know, but it's making a noise like a squadron of Italian tanks, and it's coming straight at us." The captain who commanded the Italian tank squadron was an angry, disgruntled, and horribly disillusioned man, a man burdened by a soul-corroding grudge. Like so many officers of the cavalry tradition, the arme blanche of the army, he was a romantic, obsessed by the image of himself as a dashing, reckless warrior. The dress uniform of his regiment still included skin-tight breeches, with a scarlet silk stripe down the outside of the leg, soft black riding boots and silver spurs, a tightly fitting bum freezer jacket encrusted with thick gold lace and heavy epaulets, a short cloak worn carelessly over one shoulder, and a tall black shako. This was the picture he cherished of himself, all elan and swagger. Here he was, in some devil-conceived, god-cursed desert, where day after day he and his beloved fighting machines were sent out to find wild animals and drive them in on a set point, where a mad megalomaniac waited to shoot them down. The damage it was doing his tanks, the grinding wear on tracks running hard over rough terrain and through diamond-hard abrasive sand, was as nothing compared to the damage his pride was suffering. He'd been reduced to nothing but a gamekeeper, a beater, a peasant beater. The captain spent much of each day at the very edge of tears, the deep tears of humiliation,
Every evening he protested to the mad count in the strongest possible terms, and the following day found him once more pursuing wild animals all over the desert. So far the bag had consisted of a dozen lions and wild dogs, and many scores of large antelope. By the time these were delivered to where the count waited, they were almost exhausted, lathered with sweat, and with a froth of saliva drooling from their jaws, barely able to trot after the long chase across the plains. The condition of the game detracted not at all from the Count's pleasure. Indeed, the captain had been given specific orders to run the game hard, so that it came to the guns docile and winded. After his alarming experience with the Beza Oryx, the Count was not eager to take foolhardy risks. An easy shot and a good photograph were his yardsticks of the day's sport. The greater the bag, the greater the pleasure, and the Count had enjoyed himself immensely since the arrival of the tanks. However, the wastes of the Danakil Desert couldn't support endless quantities of animal life, and the bag had fallen off sharply in the last few days as the herds were scattered and annihilated. The Count was displeased. He told the captain of tanks so forcibly, adding to the man's discontent and sense of grudge. The captain of tanks found the old bull elephant standing alone, like a tall granite monument, upon the open plain. He was enormous, with tattered ears like the sails of an ancient schooner, and tiny, hating eyes in the webs of deep wrinkles. One of his tusks was broken off near the lip, but the other was thick and long and yellow, worn to a blunt, rounded tip at the end of its curve. The captain stopped his tank a quarter of a mile from where the elephant stood and examined him through his binoculars, while he got over the shock of his size. Then the captain began to smile, a wicked twist of the mouth under his handsome moustache, and his dark eyes sparkled. "So, my dear Colonel, you want game, much game," he whispered. "You will have it, I assure you." He approached the elephant carefully from the east, crawling the tank in gingerly towards the animal, and the old bull turned and watched them come. His ears were spread wide, and his long trunk sucked and coiled into his mouth as he tested the air, breathing it onto the olfactory glands in his top lip, as he groped for the scent of this strange creature. He was a bad-tempered old bull, who had been harried and hunted for thousands of miles across the African continent, and beneath his scarred and creased old hide were the spearheads, the pot-legs fired from muzzle-loading guns, and the jacketed slugs from modern rifled firearms. All he wanted now, in his great age, was to be left alone. He wanted neither the demanding company of the breeding cows, the importunate, noisy play of the calves, nor the single-minded pursuit of the men who hunted him. He'd come into the desert to the burning days and coarse vegetation to find that solitude, and now he was moving slowly down to the wells of Chowley, water which he had last tasted as a young breeding bull 25 years before. He watched the buzzing, growling things creeping in towards him, and he tasted their rank, oily smell, and he didn't like it. He shook his head, flapping his ears like the crash of canvas taking the wind on a new tack, and he squealed a warning. The growling, humming things crept closer, and he rolled his trunk up against his chest. He cocked his ears half back and curled the tips, but the tank captain didn't recognize the danger signals, and he kept on coming. Then the elephant charged, fast and massive, the fall of his huge pads thumping against the earth like the beat of a bass drum, and he was so fast, so quick off the mark, that he almost caught the tank. If he had, he would have flicked it over on its back without having to exert all his mountainous strength, but the driver was as quick as he, and he swung away right under the outstretched trunk and held his best speed for half a mile before the bull gave up the pursuit. "My captain, I could shoot it with a Spandau," urged the gunner anxiously. He'd not enjoyed the chase. "No, no," the captain was delighted. "He is a very angry, a dangerous and ferocious animal," the gunner pointed out. "See," the captain laughed happily, rubbing his hands together with glee. "He is my very special gift to the Count." After the fifth approach by the tanks, the old bull grew bored with the unrewarding effort of chasing after them. With his belly rumbling, protestingly, his stubby tail twitching irritably, and the musk from the glands behind his eyes weeping in a long, wet smear down his dusty cheeks,
He allowed himself to be shepherded towards the west by the following line of cavalry tanks. But he was still a very angry elephant. "You're not going to believe this," said Gareth Swales softly. "I'm not even sure I believe it myself. But it's an elephant. And it's leading a full squadron of Itai tanks straight to us."
"I don't believe it," said Jake. "I can see it happening, but I don't believe it. They must have trained it like a bloodhound. Is that possible? Or am I going crazy?"
"Both," said Gareth. "May I suggest we get ready to move? They're getting frightfully close, old son."
Jake jumped down to the crank handle, while Gareth dropped into the driver's hatch and swiftly adjusted the ignition and throttle setting.
"All set," he said, glancing anxiously over his shoulder. The great elephant was less than 1,000 yards away, coming on steadily in that long, driving stride, a pace between a walk and a trot that an elephant can keep up for 30 miles without check or rest.
"You might hurry it up, that," he added, and Jake spun the crank. Priscilla made no response, not even a cough, to encourage Jake as he wound the crank frantically. After a full minute, Jake staggered back, gasping, and doubled over with hands on his knees as he sucked for air.
"This bloody infernal machine," Gareth began, but Jake straightened up with a genuine alarm.
"Don't start swearing at her, or she'll never start," he cautioned Gareth,
and he stooped to the crank handle again.
"Come along now, my darling," he whispered,
and threw his weight on the crank. Gareth took another quick glance over his shoulder. The bizarre procession was closer, much closer. He leaned out of the driver's hatch and patted Priscilla's engine cowling tenderly.
"There, my love," he crooned. "Come along, my beauty."
The Count's hunting party sat out in collapsible camp chairs under the screens, double canvas to protect them from the cruel sun. The mess servants served iced drinks and light refreshments, and a random breeze that flapped the canvas occasionally was sufficient to keep the temperature bearable. The Count was in an expansive mood, host to half a dozen of his officers, all of them dressed in casual hunting clothes, armed with a selection of sporting rifles and the occasional service rifle.
"I think we can rely on better sport today. I believe that our beaters will be trying harder after my gentle admonitions," he smiled and winked,
and his officers laughed dutifully.
"Indeed, I am hoping..."
"My Count! My Count!"
Gino rushed breathlessly into the tent like a frenzied gnome.
"They're coming! We have seen them from the ridge!"
"Ah," said the Count, with deep satisfaction. "Shall we go down and see what our gallant captain of tanks has for us this time?"
And he drained the glass of white wine in his hand, while Gino rushed over to him to help him to his feet, and then backed away in front of him, leading him to where Giuseppe was hastily removing the dust covers from the rolls. The small procession, headed by the Count's Rolls-Royce, wound down the slope of the low ridge to where the blinds had been sighted in a line across the width of the shallow valley. The blinds had been built by the battalion engineers, dug into the red earth so as not to stand too high above the low desert scrub. They were neatly thatched, covered against the sun, with loopholes from which to fire upon the driven game. There were comfortable camp chairs for those long waits between drives, a small but well-stocked bar, ice in insulated buckets, a separate screened latrine, in fact all the comforts to make the day's sport more enjoyable. The Count's blind was in the centre of the line. It was the largest and most luxuriously appointed, situated so that the great majority of driven game would bunch upon this point. His junior officers had earlier learned the folly of exceeding the colonel's personal bag, or of firing at any animal which was swinging across their front towards the Count. The first offender in this respect had found himself reduced from captain to lieutenant, and no longer invited to the hunt. And the second was already back in Massawa, writing out requisition forms in the quartermaster's division. Gino handed the Count from the rolls and helped him down the steps into the sunken shelter. Giuseppe saluted, climbed back into the rolls, swung away and bumped back up the ridge and over the skyline. The Count settled himself comfortably in the canvas chair. With a sigh, he unbuttoned the front of his jacket and accepted the damp face cloth that Gino handed him. While the Count wiped the film of sweat from his forehead with the cool cloth, Gino opened a bottle of Lacrima Christi from the ice bucket and placed a tall frosted crystal glass of the wine on the folding table at the Count's elbow. Next, he loaded the Mannlicher with shiny new brass cartridges from a freshly opened packet. The Count tossed the cloth aside and leaned forward in his chair to peer through the loophole in front of him, out across the shimmering plain, where the small, dark desert scrub danced in the heat. "I have a feeling we shall have extraordinary sport today, Gino."
"I hope so indeed, my Count," said the little sergeant, and stood to attention behind his chair with the loaded Mannlicher held at the ready across his chest.